climate change, shifting ecosystems, and mismatched migrations. From SDPB, today is Monday, June 9th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, South Dakota's plant hardiness zones shifted a few years ago. We explore the challenges that gardeners and growers face in a warming world. Our state climatologist joins us. Plus, we'll talk about climate change and an animal and an insect that migrates in and out of our state. First, USD's David Swanson talks about birdsong and how the state's songbirds are adapting to more extreme colds and warming winters. Also, the monarch butterfly may soon land on the threatened species list. How you can help them out in your own backyard. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. Today we're discussing changes, shifts, and migrations. First up, a gardening guide that shifted north thanks to climate change. When you buy your seeds or plants this year, check out the plant hardiness zone on the back. Laura Edwards discusses South Dakota's zones and why they changed a few years ago. Edwards is the state climatologist at the SDSU Extension. She joined me from SDPB's Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation studio at Northern State University in Aberdeen.
So these are maps that oftentimes gardeners and landscapers find. They used to be in the old Sunset magazines, and really this is reflecting the average or the typical coldest winter temperature and the ability of particularly plants, you know, like shrubs, trees, vegetation to overwinter through different cold temperatures. And they have it defined by different zones, each like a 5-degree range. And so here in South Dakota, we have about 4 or 5 different zones from 4A to 5B. So 4A is the coldest zone. That's right now around Brown County, Marshall County, some areas in the north. And that reflects a typical minimum temperature in the winter of negative 25 to negative 30 degrees. And the warmest zones that we have in South Dakota are 5B, which are about negative 10 to about negative 15 degrees in a typical winter.
And where are those zones? Where's the 5B?
Those are scattered throughout the Black Hills area, kind of the mid-slope or mid or lower slope areas, and then a couple scattered areas along the southern counties along the Nebraska border.
If I buy a plant, how do I know which zone it's best for and how do I know which zone I'm in?
A lot of times when you're buying, say, trees or shrubs, it'll say on the tag at the garden center what hardiness zone this is suited for. And sometimes it'll say right on the tag what that typical temperature might be. But if you want to find what your zone is, there is a USDA website, and you can just simply look up USDA plant hardiness zones, and you can find a graphic or picture of it, or you can search by your zip code and get specifically what your hardiness zone is.
So I've seen this map, and to my untrained eyes, it looks a little messy. Why is that?
So the data that lies under the map, the climate data behind it, is at, I believe, a 4-kilometer resolution. So something like, you know, a couple miles. And that climate data set for temperature is really tuned to different elevation changes. So if you look at the map, you'll see a lot of, like, river drainages in the western part of the state, especially around the Cheyenne River, Bad River area. You see a lot of these funny kind of tendrils coming out, and those are a lot of river valleys. In the east, you know, typically our terrain is a little bit flatter, so you don't see as much of the terrain or topography changes, but you see a lot of difference from north to south. So generally with the northern areas being colder in the winter and the southern areas being warmer in the winter. So that's why there's a lot of really good, I'll say resolution, a lot of spatial changes, even though the map looks a little messy.
Is this map set in stone? Like, has it ever changed before?
Yeah, this map is updated, I wouldn't say regularly, but intermittently. So the last time this Plant Hardiness Zone map was updated was in 2023. The time before that was 2012. But before 2012, really hadn't been updated since the 80s, I believe, about 1980. So they're going to kind of a more frequent schedule with USDA to update this, because in some parts of the country, they're seeing that winter temperatures are changing very rapidly, and that's really highlighted here in the northern states, especially the north central states. Our winters are getting warmer, and they're warming faster than any other season and faster than most other parts of the country, the more northern you get. So we already saw some changes from the 2012 map to the 2023 map, and not just here in South Dakota, but almost everywhere in the country saw at least one zone change from the 2012 edition to the 2023 edition. Some of the exceptions to that are some of the mountain valley areas out in the western U.S., you know, in the Rockies and, mm-hmm. and the Great Basin areas. But generally from the central and eastern part of the country, there are a lot of areas that changed from just 2012 to 2023. Just some other data here as far mm-hmm. as plant hardiness zones and their temperatures. We see typical in South Dakota temperatures warming the fastest in the Black Hills area and kind of the far western and southern part of the state by 3 to as much as 7 degrees from the 2012 to the 2023 edition. So the parts of central and east and northeast still got a little bit warmer, but at least for this last iteration, this last revision, really those changes happened faster along the west and the south.
So what should gardeners and growers in South Dakota keep in mind?
As you see these hardiness zones kind of migrate northward, maybe there's some opportunity to try some new species, some new plants in your landscape if you're interested in experimenting with a few things. But just be ready to see some things fail, you know, because we'll still see some very cold temperatures, like in Aberdeen, for example, that has the coldest zone of South Dakota, typically negative 25 to negative 30 in the winter. But we do see, you know, temperatures dip down to negative 40 or colder, you know, every few years or something like that. So we will see some winters get much colder, but some also stay warmer. You can try experimenting with a few things, see if you can protect them on those very, very cold times. But still, you know, just think about, you know, the long term, because these trees, these shrubs, you know, will be out there for, you know, probably a couple decades or more. So maybe that 20, 30 years from now, those trees have even a better chance of survival over the winter season.
That was Laura Edwards. She is the state climatologist at the SDSU Extension. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. I've been going on a lot of walks recently, especially on the Sioux Falls Recreation Trail along the Big Sioux River. I go out pretty early, which means I don't see many other people. I do, however, hear a whole lot of birds keeping me company. I was curious about who was joining me on these walks, so I connected with a South Dakota ornithologist. David Swanson is director of the Missouri River Institute and a biology professor at the University of South Dakota. He joined me from SDPB's studio in Vermilion on USD's campus.
There's a lot of stuff on the mm-hmm. Big Sioux, and woodlands in South Dakota are really probably the most biodiverse habitat for birds, and so you're going to get a lot of different things there. In our surveys that we've done, and we've done surveys on the Big Sioux and on the Missouri and in other woodlots around the area, the most common bird that we detect in woodland areas is always a house wren.
Okay.
And so that's certainly one that you'll hear for sure when you're taking a walk there. But there's a lot of other stuff that sticks around too. Baltimore Orioles are a common breeding bird, and so you'll hear them up in the trees. They really like cottonwoods.
Mm-hmm.
You find them up in cottonwoods there. In terms of other birds, I mean, there's just probably a variety. I think you can probably get 80 to 100 species in woodland habitats in the area.
So
there's a lot of stuff that you can find there.
So when you do these surveys, do you go out and count the birds?
Yes, yeah? We do. So the standard way that works when you're trying to do it for kind of a systematic scientific survey is that you arrange some typically kind of randomly oriented points within a habitat. And then you stand at that habitat for 10 minutes and you identify everything that you see or hear. And so you have to know all the calls of the birds as well. And so you do that, a 10-minute survey period at each point. And then that, and when you have a bunch of points scattered throughout a habitat, that gives you a pretty good idea of what birds are in that habitat.
How many people can do that in the state? Like, how many people can identify birds based on just hearing their calls?
Yeah, there's a bunch of us out
yeah?
there that do that. Yeah. and these days, people also kind of supplement it with the Cornell Lab puts out an app for your phone called Merlin that will use AI to identify bird songs, and it's pretty good. And so that helps people to be able to identify that too. And sometimes Merlin will pick up things that you won't pick up, and sometimes you'll pick up things that it won't. And so a lot of the surveys now kind of supplement what the people are hearing with the AI programs as well. But when we do these scientific surveys and we have people that are doing them, typically we get people that are experienced, but we also work them through a training period so that they know what the standard birds in the area are and they can identify them by sound.
So take me back to the house wren. What
yep.
does that bird look like?
It's a tiny little brown bird with it oftentimes will cock its tail. The wrens do that quite a bit. And then it sings a very kind of complex, I'd call it kind of a breezy song with a lot of different notes and very musical. Its sound is a lot more attractive, I think, than its looks. It's just kind of a little brown, mousy-looking thing.
I've never heard birdsong described as breezy before.
Yeah.
I love that. Do you have other adjectives like that you use?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I'm burry for some of the songs that have kind of a gravelly sound to them a little bit. And then there's some, like Baltimore Orioles have a really pure note, I think. And some of the thrushes have kind of a flute-like whistle. And so, yeah, there's a lot of kind of different descriptions that you can use for the sounds that they make.
So now I want to ask about, like, what the meaning of the bird song is. Do we have any idea what these little critters are saying when they're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of what is involved with the bird song, and there's kind of two general vocalizations that birds make.
Okay.
There are songs and there are calls. And the songs are typically longer, kind of more musical and more complex songs or vocalizations that are used for territory maintenance and mate attraction are kind of the primary ones for that. And then the flock calls, or calls in general, one of them can be used for kind of maintaining the flock cohesiveness. They're short, simple calls, and they're used for maintaining a flock, kind of parent-young or mate relations, and then warning calls if there are predators in the area. It's kind of like a chips or kind of like a little peep or something like that is typically a call, whereas the song is the more complex musical.
Okay, and the songs are trying to attract a mate with how beautiful they can sing.
Yeah, or territory
mate. Territory mate.
Yeah, so they kind of patrol the edge of their territory and sing to advertise to potential intruders that if you come in here, you're going to get chased out.
So it's either calling for a mate or telling other people to stay out. It serves that dual purpose almost.
Yeah. And a lot of times it's sort of focused on birds of the same species.
Mm-hmm.
they tend to respond to those songs more than other species will. Although things like alarm calls and distress calls, those, I think, are kind of generalized calls, and a lot of birds will respond to those.
I was also wondering if a bird song was for another species, can other species kind of understand the gist of what this particular bird that's calling is saying?
Yeah, but I don't know that it really matters too much for them. So if they're patrolling a particular territory, it has the resources that that species needs. But there's other species that will kind of target different things within the habitat. And so if a species is trying to guard its resources, the resources of another species might not be quite the same in terms of food types and things like that. So it's just not as important of information for them.
What time of year is best for all of this bird song, would you say?
So spring is best, because that's when I mentioned that with the bird songs, they're used for territory establishment and maintenance, and then for mate attraction. And that's all going on in the spring. That's when you're establishing the territories. That's when you're attracting the mates. And so you'll typically get song that will kind of be available really strongly kind of in May and in early June. And then it kind of tapers off through July. And then by August, it's kind of quiet out there a lot of times. And so they switch a lot from the kind of song vocalizations to more of the call vocalizations later in the summer. And then throughout the winter, a lot of it's just the calls that you hear too.
Well, I'm going to start listening for that. I had never noticed that pattern.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the songs are easier, I think, to distinguish species because they're pretty species specific, but the calls can be too. So different birds have different chip notes, and if you get experience with it, you can identify birds by the little chip or peep notes that they give too.
Okay, I'm going to ask you what might be a little controversial question, but we won't tell the birds that I asked you this.
Sure.
Who has the prettiest bird song in South Dakota?
Yeah, so that's a good one. House wrens are nice, actually, because they're really common, but they really do have a pretty song. So wrens in general, I think, have nice songs. So that's one. I like the Baltimore Oriole song because they have those really pure notes. I also like the song of the wood thrush, and you should be able to hear some of those along the Big Sioux River too. And I mentioned that the thrushes oftentimes have a flute-like call to them, and so the wood thrush has a song that has really a flute-like, I can't really imitate it, but it kind of goes, eo, eo, lee. And so they have songs that are really distinctive, I think, and attractive to our ears.
We have a top three. I love that.
I'm probably missing out on some too, because there's some I know that are that don't have the musical quality to them that I also like. Like a Bell's Vireo comes to mind on that one, which is a bird of kind of early successional cottonwood willow habitats that we find here in Vermilion along the Missouri River. And they have kind of a burry, kind of chattery song, but I really like it.
So who do you hear in your area? Do you hear the same birds that I do?
Yeah, a lot of it. In terms of woodland areas, it's going to be a lot of the same birds that are there. But there are different birds. I mentioned kind of the early successional cottonwood willow habitats. That's going to have a different set of species than the more mature forest. And then when you get to some of the upland oak forest that you might find at Newton Hills State Park, for example. And there's some along the Big Sioux, too, like at Good Earth State Park will have some of that oak forest, too. That'll have a different set of birds. And so there's some overlap, but there are some that tend to focus on particular habitats within woodlands and particular tree types that they like as well.
What about on the western side of the state? Kind of similar birds in the woodlands there?
No, it's actually pretty different, actually.
Ooh.
And that's because South Dakota kind of lies right along the 100th Meridian, which is kind of the unofficial boundary between eastern and western North America. And there's a lot of species that have an eastern North American form and then a western North American form. And I shouldn't say species. I should say species groups. Mm-hmm. So examples are like a rose-breasted and a black-headed grosbeak, a Baltimore and a Bullock's Oriole, an eastern and a spotted towhee. And so if you're in the western part of the state, you're going to get the western member of that species pair. And in the eastern part, you'll get the eastern member. So a lot of times the field guides for North America will be split up into eastern and western guides that focus on the birds of that particular area. And if you're in South Dakota, you kind of need both of them, because if you're in the western part of the state, you need the western North American guide, and in the eastern part, you need the eastern North American guide.
I did not know that. There are different flavors almost of species here.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's kind of and a lot of it has to do with once you get west of the 100th meridian, which is basically pretty close to where the Missouri River cuts through the state north to south. It gets a lot drier, and so you tend to have some species that are drier. But even the species pairs that I was talking about will occupy sort of similar habitats. But in the west, a lot of those are found mostly along stream beds.
So here it's woodlands, over there it's in stream beds.
Yeah, and there the woodlands there follow the streams is why you find them along stream beds there.
And they have to be closer to the water because it's drier on that side.
Yeah, and the water's where the trees get enough water to be able to survive, and so that's where the woodland birds tend to be associated mostly with kind of riverine systems or stream systems in the western part of the U.S. until you get up into the mountains, and then, of course, you get the conifer forest there. And that's a whole different set of birds.
That has their own special set.
Yep.
Each environment kind of has its own special set.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Do you travel to birdwatch?
I do, yeah. So I keep a list of birds that I've seen in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of travel to all parts of the state. In fact, I wrote a book, actually, called The Birder's Guide to South Dakota, that kind of talks about where you can go in the state to find birds and what birds you'll find in these different locations.
And you'll have it split between the east and the west again?
Yeah, I split it actually into five different regions. So I have the southeast and the northeast and the center and the northwest, and then the Black Hills and the southwest is how I split it up for the state of South Dakota. And all of those areas have different particular habitats and different sets of birds that you can find there.
So coming back to my personal habitat, which is the Big Sioux River.
Yep.
Do we see a lot of migration in this area?
Yes, you do. And most of that is kind of just finishing up right now.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of the peak of the spring migration for a lot of the woodland birds that are moving through is kind of mid-May, I would say. And so you'll get a lot of different warblers that nest up in the boreal forest in Canada that are coming through during the middle part of May. And so you can sometimes get 15 or 20 species of warblers in a day in the kind of habitats like the Big Sioux River at Good Earth State Park or Newton Hills. But a lot of those will move on through, and they'll just show up during migration. And so they'll nest up in the boreal forest up there in Canada. And then some of them will come back through in the fall, but they're typically not as colorful then as they are in the spring.
So again, spring is like prime bird viewing and bird listening.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of them are giving some songs during the spring. And in the fall, when they're coming back through, they'll give their little chip calls, but not really the song that you'll get during the spring.
So now I want to get into you as a ornithologist.
Yep.
Was there a specific moment when you just fell in love with birds?
You know, I kind of liked birds ever since I was a little kid. My mom bought me a field guide to the birds of North America when I was maybe 10 years old, because I had shown interest in that. And I would kind of just leaf through that guide. But really, I think when my interest took off was when I took an ornithology class in college.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really kind of started the interest. And my two favorite classes as an undergraduate in college were ornithology and physiology, and now I'm a bird physiologist, so it's funny how that works.
Mm-hmm. Did you study in South Dakota?
I didn't. I actually grew up in Oregon did my schooling out there.
What brought you here?
The job at the University of South Dakota did.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I'm interested in terms of my research is how birds adjust their physiology to handle cold temperatures. Mm-hmm. So I needed to come to a place that had cold winters, and South Dakota fit the bill for that.
Yes, we did.
I may be the only person who gets excited when it gets minus 20 degrees out in the winter, but that's pretty exciting to me because my birds are having to do something.
What do they do?
By and large, what they do is they turn into little shivering machines in the winter, and they get really good at heat production in the winter. Mm-hmm. So they undergo some changes that allow them to produce heat. And by and large, they produce heat by shivering. And so they're really good at shivering in the winter. And part of that is shivering's based in the muscles. And so one of the things we've documented is they get bigger muscles in the winter. And that allows them to increase their heat production capacity and helps them to do really well in the cold.
They bulk up in the winter.
They do. Yeah, and so a lot of times people tell me that the birds just look like these big little fluff balls in winter. And that's true, too, because what they do with the feathers, and feathers are really good insulators, but they'll lift those feathers to kind of thicken up the insulation. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like putting on a coat. But underneath that coat, they're bigger in the winter than they are in the summer, too.
So I'm thinking about climate change.
Yep.
It's going to get warmer. So why are we studying birds in the cold?
Yeah. So one of the things that you're getting is that we are getting warmer winters here, mm-hmm. but we still get the minus 20s, too. And one of the things with climate change that the predictions are putting forward is that not only do you get changes in the average, but you also get increased variability in temperature as well. So if you've got a warmer winter, but you still get the cold snaps that happen, and maybe even more often, and that still gets as cold as it used to, but you're not acclimated to the standard cold temperature because it's a little bit warmer on average, is that a problem? And so that's some of the things that we're investigating with the research that we're doing now. How do birds respond to those variable temperatures?
When the thermostat gets turned way, way, way down or way, way, way up.
Yeah, and if it's warmer outside and then you do a quick turn to those cold temperatures, is that a problem for these birds? And can they adjust fast enough to handle those rapid fluctuations in temperature?
Well, are they?
We've done some recent experiments looking at that where we've exposed birds to fluctuating temperatures and then another group to stable cold temperatures. And it looks like cold is cold from what we've been finding out so far. And so whether it's a stable cold or fluctuating cold, they do seem to adjust their physiology to handle the cold. And so maybe they're able to tolerate those cold temperatures okay. And so I think that's maybe some decent news because mm-hmm. we're the thing that we're potentially afraid of is there might be some mismatches between the kind of the capacity for heat production and the cold temperatures that might result. But it looks like the temperatures in the winter here, even though they're warmer than they used to be, are still cold enough to get the birds ready.
That is decent news. That is good news.
Yeah.
What about migrating birds? In my mind, I'm thinking these are birds that are used to going to different climates and different habitats. Are they better off?
Yeah.
So climate change?
So that's another thing that is of concern, is that a lot of times the cues that birds use for migration, a lot of that is photoperiodically based. So you get changes in day length, and the days become longer as you go from spring to summer. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of triggers the urge to migrate in these birds. And so if you've got the photoperiodic signal that is kind of stable, that's not changing with climate change at all, because day length stays the same. Mm-hmm. But if the birds are feeding on insects, for example, and you get warmer periods so that the insects hatch out earlier and available earlier, and the birds are focusing on those for food, and their migration is still photoperiodically induced, then the photoperiod signal tells them to move at the same time, but the insects are hatching out earlier, and there might be a mismatch between when the insects are available and when the birds are there to feed on them. And so that's what we're a little bit concerned about with migration. And there's some variability in different birds and how they can respond to climate change in terms of migration timing as well. So we published a study on this back in, I think it was 2009, where we looked at migration timing of birds using some data sets that were collected basically by birders in South Dakota and Minnesota from about 1970 onward. And what we found was that some birds were changing their migration dates and making them earlier in the spring, but those birds were mostly birds that kind of were short-distance migrants that wintered maybe in Texas. And so if it's cold in South Dakota, a lot of times it's also cold in Texas. But if you're wintering in Panama, if it's cold in South Dakota in the winter, the weather in Panama doesn't really tell you anything about what's going on in the migration routes or the breeding routes up in the northern hemisphere. And so those birds are basically taking off just by photoperiod changes. Mm-hmm. And so as a function of that, we're they weren't really changing their migration dates much. But the birds that were wintering closer to South Dakota, maybe in Oklahoma or Texas or the Gulf Coast or something like that, those birds tended to be moving their migration dates earlier, whereas the ones that were wintering down in Central and South America weren't really changing their migration dates very much. And that's been borne out by a number of other studies have shown that kind of same general pattern, too, is that birds that are short-distance migrants that are wintering closer to the breeding grounds tend to be pushing their migration dates forwards, but a lot of the ones that winter in Central and South America aren't. And so that still remains a concern because a lot of those from Central and South America are the warblers and things like that that eat mostly insects. And so if the flush of insects is coming earlier and their migration time isn't changing, that could potentially result in a mismatch.
They could come here and the buffet is already shut down.
Yep, that's kind of the idea.
What are some of the other challenges that climate change is throwing the birds in our area, throwing at them?
Yeah, so some things relate to kind of the climate of the nest. And a lot of the birds are warm-blooded like we are. And so they can, as adults, they can maintain their body temperature. But as nestlings, they haven't developed that capacity yet. And so a lot of the kind of thermoregulation or maintenance of the body temperature in the eggs and in the young is provided by the parents that will either kind of sit on the eggs or brood the young. And so if there are hot spells, it can provide some damage in terms of growth, but also in terms of some physiological effects that can manifest later on in life in these birds. And so there's some potential worries about that too. And that's kind of an active area of research right now, is what do the kind of different nesting climates, how do those impact birds, both in terms of growth rates and hatching and fledging success at the nest, but then in terms of later on carryover effects as well. And so I think that it's kind of too early in the research to really make definitive conclusions about mm-hmm. that, but there's certainly some data out there that suggests that it's an area of concern.
So how can we best help our feathered friends?
Yeah, I'd say habitat is still the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. And so if the birds have their habitat, that's really important. And so I think any kind of conservation sorts of things that are involved in maintaining or improving habitat quality, I think that's an important thing that we can do in terms is support habitat improvement and habitat conservation.
Is there anything we can do like in our own backyard if we wanted to make it more inviting?
Yeah, I think planting kind of native species is a good thing, because the birds in these areas are kind of adapted to use those kind of native resources. Mm-hmm. And so native trees and shrubs are always a good thing. If you can include those in your backyard, I think that makes it inviting for birds. Keep your cats inside. That's probably another good one, because they do kill birds.
That was David Swanson. He is a biology professor at the University of South Dakota and director of the Missouri River Institute. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPV. I'm Ellen Kester, in for Lori Walsh. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed listing the monarch butterfly as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. We explore what that means for the iconic orange and black insect with a milkweed and monarch researcher. Carrie Olson Manning is an associate professor of biology at Augustana University. She joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
It's not the worst level species can be at. Threatened is above endangered, which means, you know, they're not at risk for immediate extinction, but they're showing signs that they could, you know, become endangered and then possibly extinct. Populations have gone down over 80% since the 90s.
What protections would being listed on the threatened list, what would that have extended to them?
So, yeah, they receive federal protection. So that's habitat preservation. That would be things like additional research and outreach funding to let people know. Regulations on pesticides would probably happen.
Is that a big issue for them?
Yeah, pesticides are a huge issue. The largest collapses in the monarch population have happened because of, there's a new class of pesticides called the neonics, and these have been really dangerous to most pollinator populations. And so they result in deformities in the caterpillars, reduced flight success and flight behavior, and adult mortality.
How does it impact their flight?
There can be deformities mm-hmm. when they're going through pupation, like in their chrysalis. And so their wings come out a little bit crumpled sometimes. Sometimes they can't even fly. So it's a pretty serious pesticide.
I thought pesticides were getting better.
I mean, these ones are certainly getting better at
killing bugs.
Yeah, sort of. You know, I mean, we need pesticides mm-hmm. in a lot of our agricultural applications. And so there are strategies people can use to minimize these like off-target effects for our native insects. And so, you know, it's not a lost cause, but many, many states have put restrictions on these pesticides, and they've also, some of them have outlawed them completely. Yeah, that's been probably the monarch's number one most immediate concern. Also habitat loss, right? So mm-hmm. monarch caterpillars need milkweed, and there's many, many species of milkweed, but they need the milkweed to complete their life cycle. Like, it's the only type of plant they can use. And with land conversion and habitat loss, there are fewer places for them to breed.
So going on the threatened list, would that outlaw the pesticides?
Or? It would probably do a lot to help outlaw those pesticides. There'll be other federal regulations, so, you know, habitat conservation, increased research into the ways that we can, you know, best preserve the monarchs, and like public outreach. Although I don't know if monarchs need public outreach. They mm-hmm. are, everyone loves them, and mm-hmm. they are, you know, maybe one of the most well-known insects in the world, potentially, right? When species, you know, get on these lists, 95% of them have been saved. And so there's a really high success rate in, you know, when a species gets categorized on these lists. So there's hope. There's, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
So monarchs, I know, are kind of famous for having a very wide range. Like, they migrate from here to Mexico. They're everywhere in the United States. Is there any challenges to getting protections for such a wide-ranging species?
Yes, but luckily there are international organizations that work together with the different countries. Mm-hmm. So Mexico and the United States, monarchs make it all the way into southern Canada. And so these countries will work together to, you know, preserve them. Most importantly, their overwintering sites are in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot that we can do to preserve those. But there's some things we can't do, right? We can't prevent these, you know, climate instability, that is, those storms that are coming more regularly. But we can do a lot for habitat loss and just making sure that the places they like to go are protected.
Now I would like to talk more about you. Did you have butterflies decorating your room when you were a kid?
But decorating my room? No. I grew up in the country mm-hmm. on a farm, but we also had a lot of woodland. So, you know, they decorated all around me. so I was really lucky that I grew up on land. My father was really into, you know, protecting wildlife for recreational use and just because he loved native plants. And so it was a big part of my childhood, learning all these different insects. I would go, you know, find the caterpillars and watch them grow on the milkweed plants.
So was there a specific moment when you fell in love with the monarch in particular?
I don't know if there's a specific moment where I specifically fell in love with the monarchs. I mean, they're always around and an exciting thing to see. I think that I was more interested in all sorts of insects. There was a huge diversity on the land that we were on because a lot of it was not converted to farmland. And so, you know, my dad, as part of his teaching job, he was a high school teacher. He also led the FFA. And so one of the things we would do every summer is we would go out and we would collect insects and then, you know, put them in jars to preserve and send them all over to schools across Minnesota, which is where I'm from. Teams would, you know, learn from these and learn how to identify insects. I mean, and this was, you know, pre-internet. So having these specimens was really one of the best ways to learn about them, especially the native insects in Minnesota.
You kind of lived in a monarch and insect habitat.
I really did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so to me, it was just like, this is what it is. And so I think I loved all of it from the beginning.
So now I want to get into milkweeds, which you said are very, very important to monarchs. How so?
Milkweeds are the host plant of the monarch butterfly, which means the adults lay the eggs there, the caterpillars hatch out, and then they can only eat milkweed. And so milkweed is just incredibly toxic. But luckily, monarchs have been co-evolving with milkweeds for millions of years. And so the monarchs can tolerate it. And it's incredibly important, not just for them to eat, but, you know, the toxic compounds that milkweed make are also really important for the adult butterflies, because what they do is the monarch caterpillars take those toxins into their bodies, and then they disperse them as adults into their wings. And so any bird, potentially, or wasp that wants to eat a monarch caterpillar or the adult is going to get a mouthful of poison. You know, we love them because they're this orange and black. They're really beautiful to look at. But it also works as a great warning coloration. And so when the birds sample a butterfly, they will learn that black and orange means tastes bad or, you know, is not good. So they will then avoid monarchs in the future. And those compounds that, you know, cause those birds to be sick are made in the milkweed. And so, yeah, the milkweed are just in every part of the monarch's life cycle.
What's the benefit to the milkweed?
Unfortunately, there is no benefit to the milkweed from the monarchs. I know it's devastating.
It's not a symbiotic relationship. Oh, my gosh.
No, it's not. It's an herbivory relationship, which is, yeah, I guess a shock to most people, which is, that's totally fine.
That's just nature.
That's just nature. Yeah. Milkweeds need pollinators, but bees and wasps are way better at pollinating the the tiny little skinny legs of the monarch don't do a good job of capturing these pollen packets that the milkweed have, but the hairy legs of bees are. And so, yeah, the milkweed need different pollinators than the monarch. So monarchs just eat it, but they don't really help the milkweed itself.
Are they in a evolutionary arms race with the milkweed?
Oh, absolutely. Ooh. Yeah, so not only are there those chemicals I talked about. There are also these really long hairs on the milkweed. Like if you touch a milkweed leaf, it's very soft. And those hairs make it really hard for those tiny little caterpillars as they emerge from those tiny eggs to get to the leaf tissue. And then if they do get past those hairs, then we have the latex, right? The milk that comes out of the plant. If you've ever broken a milkweed leaf, you've seen it. And that just drowns them sometimes. Something like 25% of all monarch caterpillars are drowned by that latex. Again, it's nature.
It's nature.
But if they can get through that, then they can, you know, tolerate the chemicals. And then it's really an advantage to them to have been on that milkweed.
So I'm seeing that there might be some selective natural selection happening there. The caterpillars that can get past the latex are the ones who survive and then pass on their genes.
Exactly. So yeah, it's and then the milkweed are like, well, we're having some issues here with these monarchs. And so they undergo natural selection to make harsher chemicals and to do longer hairs. And so, Yeah, it is this arms race where, you know, one adapts to the challenges of the other and then the other responds.
So why would the monarchs evolve to be so dependent on one other species? Because then if the milkweed goes away, yeah, we're going to see some problems for the monarch.
Exactly. So why would it happen? You know, there are a lot of generalist herbivores that mm-hmm. can really just kind of eat anything out there. But there are a lot of specialist herbivores, and, you know, the monarchs are one of those where they have really had this tight relationship with the milkweeds for so long. And it's been a successful relationship, right? So there are, you know, millions of monarchs before the population collapse. Habitat loss and now the new pesticides have really taken a hit. But, like, you know, before all of those things, it's a very successful relationship. Yeah, milkweed are incredibly successful. If you end up planting it, you'll see that they're very resilient. Those plants do, you know, they tolerate this climate really well. They seem to be, you know, pretty stable. And so if we can just get more milkweed out there, this relationship is really an asset to the monarchs.
Until humans came along, perhaps.
Until humans came along. And, you know, we do the things. We have to farm. We have to feed ourselves. Mm-hmm. We like a nice lawn that looks, you know, not only does a nice lawn look nice to mm-hmm. us, but it also, you know, there's fewer bugs, which many of us don't like. But that also means fewer pollinators, fewer monarchs. And so, yeah, it's a balance. We really need to find a better balance with our surroundings to help these insects.
How can South Dakotans who are listening right now help the monarchs?
There are so many things people can do. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have land, I think the number one thing you can do is just convert a little bit of it to a native pollinator plot. And so you can get milkweed, obviously. There's lots of different species that are native to South Dakota. But also other native plants are so important for other insect populations. And, you know, many of those are native pollinators. You know, we've heard a lot about the pressure on bees and other pollinators. And so, you know, planting milkweed, wonderful. Planting a diverse set of native plants. And so how do you get those native plants? There are many different nurseries, not so much in Sioux Falls, but in the surrounding area. There's some in Minnesota that, you know, specialize in native plants. There's also a Native Pollinator Initiative at South Dakota State. And, you know, contacting the extension office. Yeah, there's a lot of conservation groups and, you know, they will get you in contact with some seeds or some plants. You know, it's really nice and gets it going faster if you can put plugs in. But I would say that's the number one thing people can do is try to convert some of their land to, you know, the native plants that were here before we converted it. And it doesn't even have to be a large plot, but you may find you love it, like I have in my own yard, that is just really beautiful. It's beautiful all year long. I think that is not only for the monarchs and the native pollinators, but also for you, right? Like, it's just a beautiful thing to look at. It's incredible how many different species of insects. Like, I went out one day, and I'm not, like, an expert in bees, mm-hmm. but I counted easily 10 different species of bees just in my tiny little area. Really, the prairie in the back is, I would say, 20 feet by 10 feet. Mm-hmm. And so even like a 5x5 little area, it does a lot. It's kind of incredible. And I live, you know, I live in the middle of Sioux Falls. And so I was really surprised to see so many different things.
Carrie Olson Manning is an associate professor of biology at Augustana University. And that was our show for today. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.